Classic success narratives in the United States often feature this trope of a bright young person feeling suffocated by small town life and striking out for a big city, the kind of place where dreams come true. But if that person's dreams include homeownership, a decent job, and a community that cares about the environment and one another, they could do a lot worse than staying in rural America. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If you're familiar with life well beyond the borders of a big city, it probably comes as no surprise to you that the people living in these places are mostly quite happy in their communities. So how have so many city dwellers formed this impression of their rural peers as poor, addicted, uneducated, and angry about it all? My guest wanted to understand the reality of contemporary small town life, what residents worry and dream about, and how they respond to being constantly underestimated by so-called urban elites who think they know better, even if they've never spent real time outside cities. Elizabeth Currid-Halkett is the James Irvine Chair in Urban and Regional Planning and Professor of Public Policy at the University of Southern California, the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and Kluge Chair in Modern Culture at the Library of Congress. Her book is called The Overlooked Americans, The Resilience of Our Rural Towns and What It Means for Our Country. Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really quite an honor.
So you grew up in a small town in Danville, Pennsylvania. Will you describe that place for us?
I sure can. I'm actually here right now visiting my parents and my really good friends. It's a really small town in Northeast Pennsylvania. Population has hovered between 4,000 and 5,000 people. It's nestled along the Susquehanna River. At this time of year, it is just exploding with green and foliage. It is just it's just a paradise in that respect. It's quiet. It's safe. It has local, you know, it has chain stores like, you know, McDonald's or Burger King or what have you. And then, like, you know, lots of local coffee shops and bagel shops and the Salvation Army and little craft stores. It's very prototypical when we think about small town America. Really, a place like Danville would fit the bill.
Were there things you only realized about Danville once you had also lived in big cities like Pittsburgh and New York and L.A.?
Yes, I mean, that's such a great observation. I was actually thinking about this prior to speaking with you today. So, you know, I was born in West Virginia, and my parents are Irish immigrants, and that's where they landed. And we ended up in rural Pennsylvania after my mother finished her medical training. And, you know, it was an interesting experience because I was so conscious, as many children and adolescents are, of the things that made me not fit in. So, you know, my parents have Irish accents, they still do. And, you know, they weren't American. You know, they didn't grow up here. My mom had a full-time job. I mean, she worked like 10, 12 hours a day. She was a doctor. And so I remember feeling at the time, not that I knew where I needed to fit in, but that I just sometimes didn't, you know? At the time, you know, as I got through high school, I didn't desperately want to leave. It wasn't like that at all, but it was more like, oh, I'm going to go somewhere else, you know? And I had plenty of friends who didn't feel that way, who stayed put, or they went away for college for a few, you know, for 4 years, and then they came back. And I was definitely someone who was thinking, I'm going to leave and go to university. I don't know what that means, but I'm going to do that. And when I left, I appreciated Danville more. And actually, as I've gotten older, I appreciate it even more because there is a quiet contentedness that I feel is certainly in my urban experience completely absent. And so I love it. I come here and I just like, everything is just dialed down, you know, I mean, consumerism, you know, being stressed about things, everything is just, and you could say, oh, well, you're there kind of on holiday, you're visiting your parents and your friends. And sure, but I often work from Danville. It's just, it's a whole different way of being and living. And you totally get it why people are happy in small town America. Like, you know, being here now, I see, like, it's just a different way of living. It's not better, it's not worse, it's different. And for some people, it really is a lot better, you know?
So one thing that really catalyzed this research project for you is this contemporary assumption by Americans in large urban places that their fellow Americans in small rural places are almost like a different, very angry species of human. What you've already said tells me that is not your experience.
Not at all. So, Chris, this really was the beginning of my research here. So I had, in 2017, I had a book come out called The Sum of Small Things, where I really looked at urban elites, urban elite cultural capital, how they consumed the meritocratic class and, getting into college and upward mobility and so forth. And, right around that time, we had the 2016 election. So I was writing that book kind of during that time, and it came out thereafter. And there was this sense from coastal elites that, wow, like rural America voted for Trump because they were really sticking it to us, and just also just this kind of shock that they had voted for Donald Trump. And I found that story of rural America really hard to believe. Like everything, parts are true. I mean, of course, there are probably rural Americans who are really angry. There's also a lot of urban Americans who are really angry. But I just thought that's just not the experience I had at all. Like, it was literally antithetical to how I knew the folks who lived in Danville felt about the world. And so, of course, I'm a social scientist, so I can't be say, oh, well, this was my experience, ergo it is true. I mean, of course, that's not necessarily the case. So I had to just go out and start doing some homework. So I interviewed lots and lots of people across this country to get to the bottom of this. And I also looked at a lot of different data sets. And yes, the top line result here is like this idea, this myth of this angry, poor, rural Trump voter just didn't make sense. They may have voted for Trump, true, but not for the reasons that I think the media wanted to believe or wanted us to believe.
I thought this was so interesting. You note in the book that you conducted a lot of your interviews with people, extensive interviews over the phone. What did you learn was helpful about just being able to listen to people rather than having access to other sensory information about, what they looked like, what they were wearing, the rooms they were in, that might have shaped the way you received what they were telling you?
So, Chris, this was an accidental triumph of the research. the pandemic hit at 2020. I had agreed to write this book in 2019. I had actually just given birth to my third son. The pandemic hits America's shores, and we are not able to go anywhere. And like two of my children are elementary school students, and so I'm homeschooling them. And I'm thinking, how on earth am I going to write this book? Like, this is like the full catastrophe for me right now. And so I just thought for a while, and I thought, I'm just gonna try to get people on the phone. And so I started with Danville. Now I didn't know any of the folks initially. I knew a few of the folks. I got background from some people I knew, but a lot of the people I ended up interviewing were through kind of my social networks here. I started talking to them, and I had friends who knew people in Wisconsin and friends who knew people in Missouri. And then those people would talk to me about, oh, you could talk to this person in Texas or Tennessee or Kentucky and so forth. So it actually was incredible, like such a network if I mapped it out. But what was brilliant about this, which, initially I thought this drive across the country would be fantastic, was that this made it really hard to have any preconceived notions about anyone, which was so great because you know what? I would talk to someone, and if you asked me like the first 25 minutes of the interview, is this person Republican, Democrat? Did they vote for Trump? Did they not? My answer would have to be, I have no idea. Or I'd surprise myself. I'd say this person is definitely a Republican because they live in this part of Pennsylvania. And then you'd find out that they were Democratic. Or you would think because they would have these incredibly progressive views on democracy and equality. And then you'd find out that they had voted for Trump twice, which for a lot of us doesn't square. It feels like, wait, do those two things coexist? And you realize they do for so many people that their political affiliation isn't the same thing about how they feel about their country or how they feel about each other.
So you were raised in a small town, lived there for like 13 years until you went off to college, and yet you felt like you couldn't speak authoritatively until you did this research for yourself. Elizabeth, if the vast majority of pundits and academics and journalists have more experience in big cities than small towns, what do you think feeds their confidence that they understand what's on the minds and in the hearts of people in rural areas to the extent that they can say, Donald Trump won in 2016 because rural America is mad and wants revenge?
So, my gut answer is I don't know why they think they know. No, I think there's probably a more charitable explanation. I think one is, and we know this isn't my research, but there has been some great research done on the tail. So 80% of Americans are pretty moderate, whether they're Republican, Democrat, they're pretty moderate about all sorts of issues. And then you have these tails, which are not. You've got the super left and the super right, and they're loud. They make a lot of noise and they really hold people's attention. And I think that they become a replacement for most of America. So when we talk about a divided America, it's like, oh, it's because I've talked to these four people who lived in rural America or these four people who live in coastal America, and they have loudly told me X, Y, or Z. And so that then becomes this sort of narrative of this country rather than, talking, and I'm paraphrasing President Obama here, but he had this great conversation with Marilynne Robinson about, no one's really interested in those nice folks in the middle of this country who figured out a way to get along. And I'm paraphrasing him, but it's so true. Like it's less compelling, I think. And I think that kind of leads to my second point of why I think the media doesn't engage with this idea of Americans really naturally connecting with one another is because it's just less interesting. In a day and age of 24-hour news cycle and, clicks and, ranking articles that are most read, that isn't as compelling a news story as saying the country's on the brink of civil war. And I just don't believe it is if you talk to regular Americans.
Yeah, so conflict gets attention. So we're all absorbing this information that all we do is find ourselves in conflict with people who are different from us. And then is that like a self-fulfilling prophecy, do you think?
I think it is. I think if you think about how we get our information and what that information is, it will inform what we think about the world. It's only natural, it's only human. But I think a lot on the people who don't get along and the people who are really angry, and we don't focus enough on some of the common threads that we have, the common through line that connects us as Americans. And that was something that was so clear, no matter who I spoke to in our country, that they really had a much more firm grasp on that part of the story and not the, oh, we're so divided. Although I will say, Chris, plenty of them were very attuned to the media narrative and the idea of us being a divided America. And they really did blame the media for that story.
So let's talk about some of the things that people might believe about life in small towns that may not, in fact, be accurate. Is it actually true that rural people are doing worse economically than urban dwellers on average?
No, so first, not at all. In fact, I was so surprised by the data that I checked it once, twice. My doctoral students were checking it. There is this myth that part of why rural America voted for Donald Trump is because they, felt left out of the global economic system. They were poor. They were left behind. And, I looked at Bureau of Labor Statistics and census data. And this is wrong on so many different levels. In terms of median household income, the difference between urban and rural median household income is about $5,000 on average. And it's there's obviously if region by region, it can be a little different, but that's kind of overall. And if you consider the cost of living in rural America compared to urban America, it really kind of just disappears. So even somewhere like New England, where you see a difference of about 20 grand, you know, living in Cambridge, Massachusetts is a lot more expensive than living in some very small New England coastal town. And so what I found was just even on that basic, like how much money do people have to live, that they were doing remarkably well. I also found home ownership was so much higher in rural America than urban America. And we know from, you know, lots of different research that home ownership is really important for intergenerational mobility, you know, for, you know, wealth and assets. And this is something that rural America really has a grasp on in a way that urban America does not. Even issues like unemployment, you know, in general, it's largely the same. And certain parts of rural America have really low unemployment, particularly parts of the Pacific Northwest and the Midwest. You know, people are really doing well. They're not unemployed. They're not poor. They own their own homes. And also on measures of inequality, which is so important right now, like the difference between how many people are wealthy making over 150K a year versus making less than 10K. Rural America has much less of that kind of disparity than our cities.
What is the reality about education? Why do rural areas get talked about as places where most people will be poorly educated?
You know, there is a reality. Folks in rural America are not as educated as coastal cities. That is true. I think the question as someone who has 3 degrees, it takes a lot for me to get there. But I really came to the realization from the people I spoke with and the quantitative data that while college is really important for a lot of people, there is an argument that, you know, bears out in the data that plenty of people do not have college degrees, but they have meaningful jobs, meaningful lives, and are able to live good lives without that. And then this gets into a really kind of complicated brew because, you know, the meritocracy has been lauded and critiqued in equal measure. You know, I mean, if you think about our cities, our places where it's just this treadmill of meritocracy, you have, you know, parents with their elite degrees in their elite knowledge jobs, making money so their children can take myriad music lessons and art lessons and languages and private schools and extracurriculars so that they too can get into these super competitive universities. And there has been a critique of this, really, that this is not necessarily, you know, this is Daniel Markovitz's argument in The Meritocracy Trap, which is that it's not necessarily playing out the way everyone wanted it to. And there's also plenty of people getting these degrees, paying enormous amounts of money to go to university, and still not being able to find a job. And so it's a really different contrast to what I was seeing in rural America, where that path was not the dominant path. I mean, some people were going down a path like that, but even the pressure was so different. Like when I talked to rural parents and urban parents, you know, all of them talked about their kids and adore their children and want the best for them. Like that is just a given. But with urban parents, it was just this immediate, like, you know, college, it was just expected. Whereas with rural parents, there was this sort of freedom, like, you know, they're just going to do what they want to do, not they can go where they want to go, which was the urban parents were like, college is a given. And there's some freedom within the choice to go to college of where they go. Whereas for rural parents, it was very much like college was one of a number of options. I just want my child to feel happy and loved in the world. It was a really different spirit of parenting. It kind of gave me pause, to be honest.
It does sound like a lot less pressure for all involved. Like if parents even have the ability socially to recognize that their, you know, college may be a great path for one child and not the right one for another, that's harder to do in a big city environment without your peers looking askance at you.
Yeah, and I think that that's really important is that we are responding to our social and cultural environments. And I really got that sense that certainly from the urban parents I spoke to, and that was for this book and the research I did for my previous book, just that there was just this expectation and then these kind of peer effects of, oh well, this, my friend's child is doing, piano and violin and taking a language and, doing Johns Hopkins Center for Talented Youth and is scoring this on this. And oh my goodness, is my kid going to be okay if he's not doing that? I better go do that. And I'm not sure at the end of the day that that is, it's a different, like, that may make your child successful, but it's not the same thing as your child being happy. And I feel like I can say this comfortably as a Los Angeles parent who's right in the thick of it. So I'm not judging from afar. I'm in it, thinking about it all the time myself. And I just got this sense that rural parents, it was a very different, pressure is not a word I would associate with their parenting at all.
Another rural stereotype that persists despite evidence to the contrary is that people in small towns and rural areas do not care about the environment. What you discovered is that people absolutely care, but in some ways, in their strategies for taking care of the earth just manifest differently than the strategies urban people might rely on.
Absolutely. So just in terms of sheer numbers, this is data from the University of Chicago's General Social Survey. So it's an amazing data set. I mean, the University of Chicago asks so many different people across the country year after year about everything from democracy to the environment to views on religion to views on sex. I mean, anything you want to know about what Americans think about, it's in this data set. And I looked up the data on the environment, and because particularly coastal meritocrats, coastal elites are so associated with environmentalism, I was so curious, like, what would they look like compared to their rural counterparts? And what you find is exactly the same. Rural Americans, about half of them feel that too little is being done to help the environment, and it's just over half of people who live in cities feel that way. Both a third of urban and rural respondents feel more needs to be done to help the environment, and over 60% of rural and urban respondents feel too little is being spent on the environment, and they're in equal measure really concerned about environmental pollution. So what's interesting is when you ask, the responses are very similar. I mean, this idea that, of course there are people, and I spoke to people who are skeptical of climate change and the environment, but the data suggests that most people are really in tune with what's going on. The thing that I think is really different is, and this gets into this, kind of nebulous but powerful concept of cultural capital, which is, I think, for urban folks, environmentalism is important, but it's also a very important performative aspect of their cultural capital. So the tote bags and the bumper stickers and the recycling and the compost piles are all this kind of part of the cultural capital of living in coastal cities. And I found that rural Americans engaged in practices that were as important, if not more, but without the label. Like, the one of the people I interviewed that was so I was so endeared towards was this man named Craig, and he lived in Iowa, and he was a farmer. And I remember asking him about the environment and his life, and he has a little farm, and he says, I all of my food is from my farm. And then he laughed and he said, I said something about, how he was his was it organic? Did he believe organic food was important? And he said, well, I mean, it's all my own. I think, well, maybe the fertilizer isn't organic, so I guess it doesn't count, or something to that effect. And I thought, he's just not even thinking about it through that lens. And yet this man is clearly an environmentalist and a naturalist and doing a lot for the environment by the way he lives. And yet I feel like in cities. I mean, I can speak for Los Angeles. This idea that you have your own farm is like something you broadcast on Instagram. Whereas, there's no, Greg's not doing that, you know?
So another thing that I think most people believe broadly is that the cities are pretty godless and rural areas are really centered around religious life. What did you learn there?
I learned that we believe in God or do not believe in God or feel that there is some spirituality in the world in equal measure. The data is resoundingly corroborates this, that, Americans are, there are secular Americans, and but that actually atheist, I mean, let's call it instead of secular, that's not the right term. Atheists, there are as many atheists in rural America as there are in urban America, and there are as many believers in urban America as there are in rural America. I mean, even down to one of the great questions that the general social survey asks is, do you believe you can have a relationship with God without an institution? And something like over 60% of both urban and rural Americans say yes. The thing that is different is that, and I really, this was, part of my own lived experience, I realized that all of the people I spoke to in rural America brought up their relationship with God very quickly in our conversation. I didn't ask for it. It just came up like, what's the thing that's most important to you? My relationship with God, higher power, the church, and so forth. I mean, it really came up very quickly and without any self-consciousness. And I realized thinking about my own social circle in Los Angeles and in New York, I didn't know if people were religious. I knew they were Jewish or they were Catholic or they were Protestant and whatnot, but I didn't know how they felt about God or a higher power. And I realized that this really came down to the fact that in rural America, religion takes on a really important part of cultural and social capital. It's the center of the community, it's where people socially engage, they have a lot of events, they get information. It's a part of their identity. And so it's not actually in any way to discredit that relationship. It shows how amorphous some of these things like the environment, religion, that they can be in our actual relationship with them as individuals can be quite similar, but the function they perform in our communities can be really different depending on where we are. So that was a pretty interesting difference between urban and rural America.
So, Elizabeth, you talked with rural folks who voted for Trump. You talked with rural folks who voted for Biden. What you learned was that the majority of them voted like everybody else and then moved on with their lives. They weren't especially political in the way people might imagine.
Exactly, Chris. So one of the things that I really kind of came to believe by the end of my interviewing was that, we're in a country where you get one vote and you're going to, if you're going to vote, you're more than likely going to vote for a Republican or a Democrat. And you're going to potentially vote kind of, I mean, it's not going to be an emotional experience for you. You're going to vote, I like him a bit more, or I always vote Republican, or I always vote Democrat. And that explains a lot more than this idea that the vote was to really show some sort of political point or some sort of anger. I just didn't get that. Even to be honest with you, even with the few folks that that were avid Trump supporters, and even two of them I'm thinking of who were skeptical of the 2020 results. It wasn't an anger. There was a matter of fact in their voice. And even one of them was a woman named Shannon, who I grew quite close to through the course of our interviews. I spoke to her many, many times. And we were talking, and she's a huge Donald Trump supporter and really believes, he should have won in 2020 and so forth. And at one point I asked her, I said, what do you, what do you, how do you think Biden's doing? She said, we'll see. I mean, there was no vitriol, I think that it's really important to see that for a lot of people, they vote in a kind of, the way that they did before. And a lot of data would suggest that. And one other thing, and this isn't my research, there's a really interesting paper that came out on the white working class. And of course, many of them reside in rural America. And they essentially argue that Trump is the straw man, you know, that rural America was marching more conservative with each election cycle, and that many Republican candidates, Reagan, Bush, Romney, have benefited greatly from rural America becoming more conservative, that it's not about Donald Trump, it's about rural America. It's changing a little bit in its values and its political leanings.
Elizabeth, we've talked so far about how, by and large, rural communities in this country and their residents are doing just fine. There are notable problems and discrepancies in certain parts of the rural Deep South and in Appalachia. What makes these places different from other rural communities scattered throughout the United States?
So that's a really good point. So one thing that I found was that you could talk in generalizations about rural America doing really well, and certain parts of rural America are thriving, like doing even better than, you know, folks in our really prosperous cities. So like living in Iowa, like great place to live across the board. Same thing with the Pacific Northwest. But Appalachia and the Deep South have a number of problems, and they are consistently over decades economically depressed. Appalachia in particular is unfortunately the center of opioid mortality and the opioid epidemic that we've been observing over the last 10 to 15 years. And really, if you remove, I mean, this is a really interesting, you know, when I was playing with the numbers, if you take Appalachia and the Deep South out of the data, you actually see that poverty rates for urban and rural America are identical. So a lot of rural poverty is driven by these two regions. And there's a couple of things going on. So one is the folks in these regions are significantly less educated than everywhere else. So, you know, as I said earlier, like I don't think, and it's clear from the data that everyone needs to have a college degree to thrive. But there is probably a threshold in order for a county, a community's economic development and quality of life to remain prosperous. There's a threshold of knowledge-driven jobs that need to be there. And these regions really are missing that. They also are places that don't have not experienced as much of the spillover of the knowledge economy jobs as other rural areas. So something that I found in my data, and I can go into it more later if you would like, is that, you know, a lot of the jobs that we associate with our cities, like, you know, finance and law, software, when you look at Bureau of Labor Statistics data, you find that they have spilled over into our rural towns, which is why our rural towns aren't doing so badly at all. That it's, you know, I grew up as a student of regionalism and economic geography of thinking, oh, we have these global cities and they essentially isolate from the rest of the world. And it's a little more nuanced than that. So, you know, like software publishing, it grew by like over 300% between 1990 and 2020 in rural areas. So they have really benefited. But Appalachia and the Deep South have not benefited in the same way that other rural American towns have. So that coupled with opioids in Appalachia. And then the other layer is that some of these regions, and this in particular, this is the case with Appalachia, they were great beneficiaries of mining when mining was actually growing, which it actually was even into the 21st century until it didn't anymore. And for myriad reasons, including environmental regulation, mining is no longer prosperous. So a lot of those counties that had those jobs just went and there was nothing to replace them. And a lot of the start of the opioid epidemic was a function of mining injuries. And when people were injured in the mine and they were prescribed opioids, and then there wasn't a job afterwards, you got into this toxic brew. And I'm borrowing from Angus Deaton and Anne Case, but this idea of deaths of despair, and I would say, you know, lives of despair, where it was a really hard cycle to get out of in certain parts of our country.
Are those folks angrier than average in Appalachia and the rural Deep South?
You know, they were not. So that's what's really interesting. Actually, one of the people outside of Shannon grew up in Kentucky, and this young man, Clay, and these are both folks who live in one of the poorest counties in America. They weren't angry. It's really peculiar. I feel this is another book. I want to find those people because I just didn't come across them. I know that they exist. This isn't, I don't think it's a myth that there's angry people out there who feel left behind. I'm sure there are. I just didn't come across them, even in the heart of the places where they were supposed to be.
Let's talk about this. Another stereotype that I think many urban residents hold is that rural folks might be more narrow-minded than city folks, more prejudiced along racial lines. What did you find when you sat down and talked with people?
I found the opposite. So I can tackle this question through both qualitative interviews and the survey data. When I talked to rural folks about equality in this country, one of the questions I ask is, what is your definition of equality, and do you believe it exists in America? And all of them said, I believe equality has to do with being treated equally, regardless of the color of your skin, regardless of your gender. And also, no, it doesn't exist in America. I mean, these folks were really, really dialed in to the problems of our times. They really got it, and their answers were reflective of the answers I would hear from progressive folks in our cities. And the data actually shows it too. In fact, the data shows something even more complicated, which is that rural folks, particularly the least educated, were at times even more supportive of social policies towards women and towards minorities than urban educated folks. So, for example, 80% of rural residents agree or strongly agree women should be hired or promoted versus 73% of urban folks. 21.4% of rural Americans with a bachelor's degree believe government should support the Black community versus 19.8% for those same folks in cities. And this happened more time and time again, where you saw that the people you would think would be least supportive of uplifting our minority communities were actually very, very open to it. And this is very timely given the Supreme Court ruling, 40.5% of rural Americans without a high school degree do not think it's likely that affirmative action will hurt whites. And this is versus 53% of urban folks with bachelor's degrees. Now, those are different numbers, but they're not in totally different universes. And given that educated urbanites are already in a position of social mobility more so than these rural folks without a high school degree, the difference is, I don't think, as great as it might even seem. This was something that regularly happened. Like, for example, almost 40% of rural Americans without a bachelor's degree support preferential hiring for Blacks versus just 30% of educated urban Americans. So it's pretty surprising data, but it's really reaffirming that our rural citizens are as open-minded as their urban counterparts, and at times more so on these really important issues of our time.
On the other hand, you've noted that some people who hold what we call woke views seem unwilling to extend their empathy and compassion to rural folks.
Yeah, so this is something that I think is really tough. And I think when Democrats are trying to figure out how to message to rural America that this is something to keep in mind. I think many of us, I'm certainly not the first one to say that wokeism has a kind of paradox in it, which is that it is really, really open, except to the people they feel they shouldn't be, and then they're very intolerant, you know. So if you it, you know, so rural Americans may not get the same kind of openness or understanding, or let them, you know, express themselves, you know, that would be dealt with differently by woke culture. And I think one of the things to me that really stuck out was that rural Americans are very happy in and of themselves, but they are extremely aware of how they are looked down upon, treated differently. One woman I talked to said, "Oh, I think urban Americans just think we're a bunch of hillbillies." She didn't say it with anger. It was like a matter of fact to her. And so I think it's really important that, you know, when we think about, you know, Hollywood and coastal media dominates what kind of cultural capital we think matters, that everyone has cultural capital. Everyone has the things about themselves that they want to express. And what I think is tough for rural America is that it's often ridiculed, whether it is their religiosity or whether it is their, you know, homegrown kind of small town beliefs and community, that's looked down upon rather than treated as just a different form of cultural capital. And I think if there's anything sort of political to take away here, it's that we can't look down on people because they're different. We have to sort of say that, you know, and we have to sort of try to understand where people are coming from, even in difficult issues like marriage equality, where, you know, it was very tough for me to talk to folks who weren't on board with marriage equality because I am such a proponent of it. But it's really important to understand why people feel the way they do, because we're not changing this country by looking down on people. We're changing this country by getting in the same room with them. And again, that's, you know, one of Barack Obama's phrases, which really resonated with me, is you just got to get in the room with people and understand where they're coming from. And then there's real change that can be made.
What have you learned, Elizabeth, about how we can talk to one another across these geographic divides, especially if they don't turn out to be as significant ideological divides as we might believe?
There's a couple of things that really I took away from these interviews. One was, I think if we strip away politics and we just say we're going to talk to each other as Americans, as human beings, we find we have an enormous amount in common. You know, we care about our kids and our family and our parents and our holidays and the environment. Most of us want to do the right thing, you know, and, you know, that is more important than who we cast our vote for. And I know that not everyone would agree with me on this, but I really feel it. We have really lost track of our humanity in being so preoccupied with our politics. And so that was a big thing for me. The other thing is, I really think that we need to understand each other, and even if that's uncomfortable. So I had a number of folks. There was one, I've alluded to this woman, Shannon, who I interviewed, and I mention her a lot in the book. You know, on paper, we couldn't be more different. I mean, she is skeptical of climate change. She is wary of marriage equality. She supported Donald Trump twice. She's has, you know, believes in certain conspiracy theories. She didn't get vaccinated. And on paper, politically, this is just the opposite of my way of being. And yet, I developed a warmth and connection with her as a person. And part of that was the fact that I listened. And it's not empathy, because empathy is when you can sort of get where someone's coming from. I didn't get where Shannon was coming from. It's more that you decide, I don't understand. We're not the same person, but I'm really, really going to get here and listen to you and absorb what you're saying and try to understand where you're coming from. And I think that that's where we can see important change in our society. It's not just the kind of politically motivated, how do Democrats get more rural voters? It's also just like, if this country feels divided, if that's the perceived narrative, then the really important thing to do is to try to really understand where we're all coming from. And that goes both ways, by the way. It's not just that coastal elites need to really relate to rural Americans, rural Americans, also have to get on board with some of the things they may not be comfortable with.
Elizabeth Currid Halkett is the James Irvine Chair in Urban and Regional Planning and Professor of Public Policy at the University of Southern California, also the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship. Her book is called The Overlooked Americans, The Resilience of Our Rural Towns and What It Means for Our Country. Elizabeth, thank you for making time for the conversation.
Chris, it's been a delight to speak with you. Thank you.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and get the podcast wherever you like to get podcasts or listen anytime at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.